This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Bradford Morrow. He's the author of The Diviner's Tale, a novel. Hey, Brad, how are you?
Hi, David. Good to hear from you.
Great to talk to you. Before we talk about The Diviner's Tale, because you have, you know, you've written a lot of books and you've been an editor, and I just want to talk a little bit about your past work as lead-in to this book, which I think is a really interesting evolution in your work. Maybe you could talk a little bit about just how you first became a writer, where this came from in your work.
Well, I suppose I always wanted to be a writer. I remember winning a short story competition back in seventh grade for a story called Tor. It was a first-person narrative of a young boy who was kidnapped by gypsies or something, some crazy stuff. And, you know, then I wrote poetry, I tried my hand at playwriting, and ultimately fiction became the form for me that worked best. As far as The Diviner's Tale, looking back over the arc of my various novels, I've always had an interest in the Gothic. Back in the 90s, I edited with the British novelist Patrick McGraw a book called The New Gothic, and we collected a couple of dozen writers from England and America who we thought, you know, had a very Gothic strain in their work, even though some of them weren't necessarily considered Gothic writers. Like Martin Amis wouldn't think of him as Gothic just per se. And other writers like Jamaica Kincaid, for instance, John Edward Wideman. We found a Gothic strain in some of it. So I've been interested in the Gothic from way back, and I suppose my first real try at writing a Gothic was with the Almanac Branch, although that was very psychological, very kind of interior book. I seem to write two kinds of books. One is like Trinity Fields, Ariel's Crossing. Maybe even my first book, Come Sunday, has a kind of political, macro, global kind of approach to things, dealing with war and sort of large human issues. And then I write a kind of a novel that is in this Gothic strain. And I would say that Giovanni's Gift was the book in the late 90s that maybe was the book that came before Diviner's Tale that showed some of these interests in noir, in the sort of the darker side of human endeavor.
And the Diviner's Tale is both interior, highly interior, because and I guess this, you know, maybe a little synopsis of the story is that you have this character, Cassandra Brooks, who is the diviner, which means someone who is, in this case, particularly a dowser, but she has this sort of second sight capability. She's walking in the woods in one of her dowsing assignments, and it starts with this vision of a young girl hanged from a tree. The book takes off from there, obviously, and we don't want to give it away, but it's very much about her interior life and the conflict between her understanding of this gift, her relationship to her father, who was a dowser before her, and the world around her. The book is set in, I guess, what I would call the Hudson Upstate Valley, upstate New York Hudson Valley.
Somewhere between the Hudson Valley and the Delaware.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
river.
It's actually right closer to the Delaware River.
I invented a county as if New York State needs another county. But
yeah, I was thinking it might be like around Fish's Eddy, somewhere over there.
Yeah, it's over in that direction. In fact, yeah. I renamed Fish's Eddy and put I call it like Little Eddy or something along those lines. And the other scenario for the book is up in Maine, actually, an island that's off the Cranberry Island,
right,
near Mount Desert Island, which is called Covey Island. I think it was kind of important to have both these spaces as a kind of imagined space, even though they're very firmly based on, you know, these two locales that I know very well. But at any rate, yeah, it's upstate, and she's dowsing, and as you say, she comes upon this what turns out to be a vision of a hanged girl in a tree, and she brings back. I don't think we're giving anything away. She brings back the authorities, including a childhood friend who happens to be the sheriff named Niles, and they discover exactly nothing. She's completely shocked by this, that the girl is gone. And
she realizes after recognizing that it was a vision and not something that was as quote real,
right,
that it was real in another way, and this is a struggle for her. It's part of her internal struggle to come to grips with whether she should follow the gift, because in her past it was very fraught, as you have her in her, you know, earlier time in her, you know, preteen years or teen years, having a great deal of difficulty with the emotional content of being, of having this gift, and it's connected to, I guess, her brother. It is connected to her brother, where, and I guess this is a key part of the story that is really the beginning, and that is that her brother had died in an accident that she had had visioned prior and had not told him to not go there.
Exactly. Well, these four visions, as she calls them, have haunted her since, you know, early on in her life. And at a certain point, she has twins. She's has a job as a part-time school teacher and as a dowser. And I think she believes that she's, you know, beyond these four visions, and she's tried to create a normal life for herself. Well, all that comes, you know, crashing down around her ears with this vision in the woods and this very lonely valley. And what I think we can leave it at the fact that they go back the next day and discover a real girl who is a kind of doppelganger of the hanged girl, who's very much alive, quite mute, clearly has been displaced. She both did not see, and she also did see, and that really is what sets the book into motion. And I think it's fair to say that what she, as she goes forward through the course of the book, she's really discovering her past through these one event after another, and so it's she's kind of, her past lies ahead of her, and really kind of the most incredibly dramatic ways and upsetting ways imaginable.
Right, and it's kind of an uncovering, a series of uncoverings, that both for her and for, of course, for us as readers, we learn increasingly about her past and how it all connects to the present.
Right,
and I think we should probably leave it at that. Mm-hmm. But you know, I will say, I think the book is very liquid in, you know, in the sense of the story unfolding. It was, you know, you feel, I mean, as a reader, it's you very deftly, I would say, as the storyteller, you've put this together in a way that, you know, the readers don't feel the levers moving. We don't feel like the, you know, we're being manipulated, as, you know, sometimes in stories you kind of recognize how people have constructed the story in order to achieve an effect. And I didn't feel that way at all. That the story felt really natural to me unfolding. And I thought that was a pretty, you know, that's an accomplishment on you, for you. To have been able to do that, because it's a fairly there is a lot of complexity to the story, you know, in all these relationships. There's a whole subtext of her relationship to her father and his decline as he has gotten older, her relationship to her mother and her mother's, you put her mother's family is the main connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So she's got this sort of anodyne of Maine coastal, that's the female, and then this woods, river location, which is the father's place. And Cassandra, the main character, has to go between both of these. And mysterious and difficult things happen in both places.
That's very interesting that you noticed that, because that is something that I've put in there, but it's not touched upon, directly in the novel itself, in the narrative itself, so that's interesting. The book doesn't really follow conventional whodunit or detective or even mystery conventions. It just... It's a literary novel that is both a mystery and has, I suppose, you could say, supernatural or paranormal elements in it, unless you believe in dowsing and divining. I went to a beginning dowsing school when I was working on the book because I wanted to kind of find out how that worked from the inside out. I wanted to get into it as far as I could manage, and I even have a certificate, although I would not hire myself out to you, David.
Well, no, because I think, actually, as you have it in the story, and I believe this is true, that you either have it or you don't.
I think everybody is kind of a diviner in a way. I think it's a beautiful metaphor for intuition and for the imagination and for one's ability to see kind of past the surface of things and... into a richer understanding of what's just around the corner, what's just ahead.
But I think it's like many of those spiritual practices, which are clearly not for. There's a sort of initiation that's involved that you have to understand why you're doing it. That it's not. It's almost as if the word divine, as part of diviner, the connection to the divine is really important. That you. You're bridging the material and the spiritual, and you have to do it in a pretty aware way in order to not abuse the gift.
Well, this book had the most humble beginnings of any novel I've ever written, and it really began with my basement in my house, my old farmhouse upstate, which was constantly flooding. Whether it was raining or not, it just seemed I always had a... now and again had a foot of water down there, and I brought in a friend who was an excavator, and he said, I could bring in a backhoe here and just tear up the yard until we find the source of this problem, or I'll bring in a water witch, he called it. And I thought, let's see what the water witch says. So this little guy shows up. Somehow I have him wearing a bow tie. That may just be apocryphal. I might have just painted a bow tie on him in my imagination, but... he took out a divining rod from his truck and started zigzagging back and forth across the lawn in front of the house. And at a certain point, the stick would just, the tip of it would violently jump downward. Just amazing. Even though his hands were perfectly motionless, he'd pull a little piece of tape out of his back pocket, drop it on the spot, and keep going. Well, when he was done, this took about 20 minutes or half an hour. I was just watching this thing with my mouth agape at what I was seeing, wondering, in fact, what was going on here. He came over and he told the excavator and me, all right, well, what you have here is an underground stream such and such a distance down. It's an L-shaped. The problem here is in this L, and he just described basically the hydrogeography 20, 30 feet down in front of my house. And I paid him $50 or whatever it was, and he went away. They brought in the backhoe, dug to his precise locations, and they discovered exactly where he said it would be, this underground stream shaped just as he predicted it would be. And a little bit of perforated PVC pipe and some peystone gravel, and I have a dry basement now. Well, what fascinated me was not only what I was seeing, which I was, inexplicable to me, just ineffable, but the rich metaphoric value of what I just witnessed. Someone who could read past the everyday, read past the what we're used to,
and get it beyond the surface.
Beyond the surface, and I thought, wow, there's something there. There's a book there, or a story, or an essay or a something. So I just took some notes and then frankly proceeded to forget about it for 6, 7, 8 years, and wrote a couple of other books, and that it kept nagging at me, this dowsing business. And I saw a picture of someone's hands with a divining rod, and I actually clipped it out of a magazine, and I put it up on the fridge, and started working on the book. Once I had Cassandra's voice, and I had this idea of dowsing your past, you know, dowsing something you've suppressed, something you've really tried to forget, then I was fully underway.
Right. Now, that's an interesting way of thinking about it, too, that for Cassandra, her dipping into her past is sort of without her control, the way the image of the dowsing rod that you just gave is sort of how her experience of her past works, that she's drawn into it without any option, that drawn down to that past just the way the wood would be.
I think that's why the book reads in the way you said it reads, it unfolds in the way you mentioned, because it's not the kind of mystery that evolves through a course of author pulling sleight of hand on reader.
Right. Right. That's why I really felt strongly that it was not. In fact, I think I mentioned this to you before we started to record. I didn't even realize it was a mystery. That didn't occur to me while I was reading it. I just read it as a narrative of this unfolding story.
It's really, as much as anything, it's a portrait of a woman at the edge,
right.
A woman who is trying to come to grips with her own capacities as a seer, as a mother, as a daughter, as a person in the community, as a single mother.
That's true. She has a lot of struggle, you know, that in the community she's not always respected and is in fact thought of as a kind of wacky person and not believed.
A bit of a pariah even at times. And, you know, of course her mother is very religious, and that's never been Cass's cup of tea, because she was more raised by her father, really, than her mother. And he, you know, he's I wouldn't call him an atheist. He's a spiritual guy, but he certainly doesn't attend church like the mother does.
Right, he actively doesn't attend church.
Exactly.
And then she also has this struggle with the sheriff, who you mentioned before, Niles, who she, you know, not only was friends with, but really had a crush on when she was young, and for whatever reason, it didn't work out, and now he's married, but they're still friends. And in a small town, that's not so easily accepted either. Being, you know, a male and female friendship in adulthood in small towns is often looked at as, you know, let's say unusual and unacceptable.
Well, so getting back to genre, that's why if you approach this book and you're just looking for a whodunit, it'll keep you up at night. I have a lot of people who have written me and said, "Well, you kept me up two nights, three nights in a row late, and I really appreciate it. On the other hand, I got to catch up with my sleep." So it does have that kind of mysterious element in it, but it also is a mashup. I mean, it's a literary novel. It's a psychological exploration. It's about some people started blogging about child abuse. You know, about there's abuse that's dealt with as a subject in the book, and really there's a lot about nature in the book too. It's a real funny. I was reading a book by the great P.D. James after I'd finished The Diviner's Tale. She had a little book out recently called Talking About Detective Fiction, and in it she mentions a guy named Ronald Knox who wrote a preface to the best detective story of 1928 or 29, somewhere in there. And it's kind of an Aristotle's Poetics of detective fiction that someone Knox put together. And I realized I'd broken every last rule that you know, of the whole detective genre. And I thought, well, that's great. this is fantastic. You know, break it open, mash it up, mix it up. I think genre right now is some of the most interesting fiction being written, and I think the more people feel free to mix it up with conventions and try new ways of you know, writing mysteries or supernatural or even literary fiction, the better. I think it's very liberating, in fact.
Well, it's an expanding universe, and
exactly.
You know, I think that you know, there are, the genre notion can also be, it can be narrowing at the same time as it can often open possibilities. It's sort of like, you know, the exercise that a lot of aspiring writers are given is to, you know, write a villanelle or write a sonnet. Mm-hmm. You've got the structure, so you don't have to worry about that. But I think once you get good at language, then you want to be able to create your own structure.
Right.
And I think, you know, clearly, you know, you have all of that ability. I just one or two questions more I wanted to ask you about that were interesting to me, you know, maybe mundane, but obviously Cassandra's name itself, herself, the name itself for her, for your main character, harkens to Greek mythology.
Right.
And I kind of thought, well, maybe that her twins have something to do as well. And, but then I thought, well, but then the hanged woman, that's a tarot image.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of interesting how you've mixed in the very, you know, as you say, mashup may actually be what you were doing. I don't know whether you were doing this consciously or not, but you've got a lot of kind of mythological elements here, too.
Well, Corinth County, you know, there's a lot in there that's put in there on purpose and references to Agamemnon and other. I love subtextual sort of inside jokes, as it were. I love
right.
subtextual references.
The sheriff's name, Niles, being an Egyptian reference, maybe?
Yeah, of course. And
yeah.
Covey Island, even the coves. I mean, there's a lot of water. Right. The book is really...
Water is clearly the theme of so much.
Right. And the flow of the book, you know, from the first book I can remember where I actually numbered chapters. I have like 30, I believe, 30 chapters, and they're numbered. So it's meant, well, the book is flowing all over the place because you'll be on one plot thread, and then the chapter ends, and then you'll be coming from another angle. And but it's meant to give you the sense that we're going to get to the end of this. It's, you know, there is a linearity to it, even as it meanders, like a nice old river, you know, and you fly over the Mississippi and you fly across the
country. Right, the river always gets there eventually.
The water gets there eventually, and sort of stream of life. I just found the name Cassandra just too irresistible. And, you know, she's called Cass throughout the book, so I don't think, I think once it's introduced, I think the reader tends to forget about
it. Oh, yeah, it's not
just reality.
It's just one of those things you think about, you know, along the way.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I was kind of interested in was just why it was that you picked the Cranberry Islands, or was it just because you know them and you've been there and they're part of your life?
Yeah, it's the latter. I didn't put a lot of deep thought into where it should be set. I just knew I needed an island, and I had spent a lot of time in the 80s, late 80s, early 90s up there, and, you know, Mount Desert Island, which I adore. And so I went back after I'd done the dowsing school. I just wanted to see what it felt like up there, like if I still responded to it. And, yeah, it was something about a lighthouse as well, like just something, again, looking out into distances where you really can't otherwise see things. I thought that was very rich in metaphor value. And to have a small piece of land just surrounded by a different body of water, where you're just kind of clinging to an island, and then the island is meant to be a safe place. And of course, she discovers that she's not any more safe on that island.
I got to say, that was one of the most chilling scenes for me, was when, and I felt that palpably, the sense that she had lost her safety, that someone, and again, I'm not going to give it away or anything like that, but there's just that there was this moment in the book where you could feel her world shifting, that, you know, your ability to be safe is suddenly threatened. by an event that shows you that you are not without, you're not alone, you're not safe. There's someone out there who is who knows where you are and who knows your intimate secrets and who's been able to invade your space in a private way. That was terrifying.
Well, I remember writing those scenes, and actually, now that you're saying it, I'm feeling the same anxiety I felt when I was actually writing them. Some of those island scenes, because she feels that she's safe, and she has this moment where she's with the two boys, and she's at this very small place at the end of the world in a way, and everything's fine. And that island reminds me a little bit of The Tempest, too, but there definitely are some Greek myth references throughout the book, sort of subtly built in. But there's also The Tempest is present in this novel in a lot of ways, the whole Prospero. I even mentioned Prospero regarding her father, that he's sort of a poor man's Prospero. But yeah, when you find out that the island, when she finds out that the island is not a place of refuge or safety, then all bets are off, really. Then the whole fragility of the very idea of safety comes into the forefront.
Right, and of course, after that, I realized that what I'd also been thinking about was that an island, while it might be a safe haven, is also a very scary place because you are cut off from support as well as cut off from danger. And so there's the ambiguity of any island that kind of, it just highlighted it. I'm not sure whether it necessarily was your intention, but I really felt that, you know, she had to then be more terrified, not just because her safety had been given up, but because she was experiencing the reverse, the ambiguity of so much.
And once she experienced the fact that she's no longer safe there, then she has to go back. She has to go back to where this all began and face the reality of the fact that there is someone very much alive who very much intends to harm her, and her doppelganger, Laura, is also, with a whole other, part of the story, is this girl, Laura, who is essentially Cass's doppelganger.
Right, it's her young self alive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's in the only other, so there's a little bit set in New York, and then the only other bit is up in Cold Spring, which is in the Hudson Valley, which we were talking about earlier before we were doing the podcast. And it's a beautiful, but I find very spooky little town right on the Hudson River. So all the places, Manhattan is an island as well, so every location is somehow connected with water, and water is the centralizing, metaphor through the book as the book, flows along.
Right, and the water under, even though as to the, the diviner, the water is underground, and the diviner's job essentially is to find the hidden water, and water being this sort of spiritual metaphor itself. It's your body in another form.
Right.
I think it's a wonderful book, and really captivating, and I understand exactly the people who were telling you that it kept them up, because there are some books which you just feel like you've got to read. They it's not a chore. They just pull you in, and this book certainly has had that effect on me.
Oh, I really appreciate you saying so.
That's a wonderful book. So maybe tell me. I think you had mentioned that you've got another book. I think it's coming out imminently. It's a collection of short stories.
Well, I have a book that was published yesterday called The Inevitable, which is a collection of essays that I co-edited with David Shields, and it came out with Norton. It's a collection of so-called creative nonfiction. I'm not sure I like that term, but of very beautiful literary essays on the subject of death. That just came out. I had my backlist of novels was just published last week as ebooks with Open Road Media, and that's a very interesting world, the whole ebook world as well. And then in the fall, I have my first collection of short stories, which I've been writing stories for the last, I'll say, 20 years, and I collected together a dozen of them that sort of fit, again, in a fairly dark, somewhat gothic, noirish kind of, they have a character of noir they share. And so that book is called The Uninnocent, and it will be published by Pegasus Books in late November.
Well, obviously you are a busy writer.
Right now I seem to be.
Right. So how does it feel to have is the backlist out as ebooks? Are you going to work on promoting those or do something to let people know they're out there?
Sure, because I'm come Sunday, the Almanac Branch, Trinity Fields, Giovanni's Gift, Ariel's Crossing are all currently out of print in paperbacks, and so the way, unless you can find them in a used bookstore, which, I love books. We've known each other some time. I've been a bookseller. I've been a bookbinder. I've done everything with a book you can imagine. And so I love bookstores. But ebooks are a way to reach out to a reading public as well. And I spent a couple of days with Open Roads of Film Crew, and they did a lot of filming of me and several other writers, Karen Russell, Robert Olin Butler, and Peter Straub, talking about my work. And so Open Road, on their website, you can see a video of me talking about writing in general and some of the books specifically. And so, whatever they want me to do, I'll happily do it, just treating it just like I would any book.
Yeah, no, I think ebooks have a tremendous appeal right now, just because they're easy. They're easy to handle.
Right.
it's you don't have to. It is difficult to have as many books as some of us have.
Right.
I think you can love print books, and I think you can love reading digitally just as easily. I actually will take a look, because I have some of your older books in cloth. In hardcover, but I don't have all of them, so
right.
I think this will be a good way for me to find your other books.
Yeah, exactly. They're a wonderful publisher. Jane Friedman was who runs Open Road Media. She was a real superstar in the print world, and she made this move some years ago, and I think it was very decent on her part to do this. And I suppose you can say, I like ebooks. No, I like books. I like, for a writer to be able to reach out to readers, which is the whole point, through any media possible, whether it's a bound hardcover or whether it's a paperback original, like The Inevitable is a paperback original. The Diviner's Tale is a hardcover. The backlist is ebooks, and this anthology with Norton that just came out as a paperback original. I'm coming out in every.
That's right.
Almost every conceivable format, and I frankly love them all.
Right. No, I think you're right. I think that the issue is, and I think this is true for readers as well, ultimately it's still about the words.
Mm-hmm.
And, we do have a certain interest in the physical object, some of us more than others, but ultimately it really is about reading and access and connection. And however you can connect a reader to a writer, I think it doesn't really matter.
Well, that's just very eloquently put. I couldn't say it better myself.
Well, thanks, Brad. I do want to mention your website, which I really enjoyed taking a look at. It's bradfordmorrow.com, and for people who are listening, it's probably a good thing to visit. Some of the blurbs and comments about The Diviner's Tale are pretty extraordinary and definitely worth looking at. So I want to thank you, Brad. It's been a pleasure talking to you. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to Bradford Morrow about his book, The Diviner's Tale.
Well, thank you, David.
Take care.